Recording from my living room in beautiful Marietta, Georgia, you are listening to the Think Inclusive Podcast, Episode 7. I'm your host, Tim Villegas. Today, I will be speaking with Dan Habib about his new film, Who Cares About Kelsey? The film will be broadcast on public television beginning the weekend of September 28, 2013. In addition to the film, there are 11 mini-films available to watch on the website, whocaresaboutkelsey.com, that support the message of inclusion and positive behavior support. Dan and I talk about positive behavioral interventions and supports, the importance of leadership in systems change, and the all-important question, who we think is going to win the World Series. So, without further ado, let's get to the podcast. Thanks for listening. Joining us today on the Think Inclusive podcast is Dan Habib. Dan is a former photojournalist turned filmmaker whose award-winning documentary about his son, including Samuel, captured the hearts of the disability rights community, including my own. His most recent film, Who Cares About Kelsey, follows high schooler Kelsey Carroll in her senior year as she attempts to graduate, at the same time coming to grips with her history of abuse, neglect, failing grades, and ADHD. The film challenges us to reframe our concept of the problem student and gives us an approach that is much more empowering and proactive. Dan, thank you for taking some time out of your day to speak with me.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Great. I know that for many of the people who listen to this podcast, Dan Habib does not need an introduction, but a lot of us know you from your work in Including Samuel, and that just chronicling what full inclusion looks like for your son. What kind of connections do you think can be made from your first documentary, Including Samuel, to what your most recent Who Cares About Kelsey? Do you see that there are similar themes about inclusion, about never giving up on a student, and were those intentional at all?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I think there were a lot of connections, and really doing Including Samuel and traveling around the country with it led to this film. And I never would have done this film if I hadn't had the experience. As you probably know, Including Samuel is books is largely on my son Samuel, as you mentioned. And Samuel has a pretty amazing kid. Of course, I'm biased, but he's got a huge sports fan. We live in New England, so he's big into the Red Sox, the Patriots, and NASCAR. He loves science. He loves social studies. He's in eighth grade now. He's doing really well. He's been on the honor roll. He's also a kid who has cerebral palsy and uses a communication device for most of his communication, has a feeding tube. You know, I describe him in different ways. He uses a wheelchair for mobility. And I was fortunate in that when I did the film, Including Samuel, I had really no idea where it was going to go. I just felt like it was a film I had to do. Mm-hmm. But it led me around the country, and I've shown it, I think, more than 400 times at this point in more than 40 states and multiple countries. And the thing that was interesting is almost everywhere I went, people would ask lots of questions. And one of the questions that came up again and again was, do you think it might be harder to include kids with more hidden disabilities than a really obvious disability like Samuel's? And so I started thinking about that and doing some research, and the first question was, well, what's a hidden disability? So I think that's important for us to just touch on, because a hidden disability is a huge swath of kind of labels or categories, whatever you want to call them. It can include mental health issues like schizophrenia or bipolar. It could be post-traumatic stress. It could be anxiety, depression, fetal alcohol syndrome, you know, you name it. It could be caused by genetics. It could be caused by environmental factors like poverty or abuse. It could be caused, you know, by neurological issues. And so what I found in talking with people is that a lot of educators were actually having a more difficult time including and supporting kids with these hidden disabilities. And in fact, the outcomes for kids with these types of disabilities is awful. I mean, you have about over 50% dropout rate. Mm-hmm. You've got about 65% of these kids are not included in general education classrooms. So the vast majority are not included. They are twice as likely as a kid with any other kind of disability to be incarcerated, addicted to drugs, a teen parent, or living on the street after graduating. So all those factors and conversations and statistical research led me to want to do a project that could be a catalyst for change for kids with hidden disabilities, just like Including Samuel has been, for kids, primarily, I think, with physical disabilities.
So how did you find out about Somersworth High School? Is that because of the proximity of where you live?
That's part of it. The film, Who Cares About Chelsea, is filmed at Somersworth High School. And what happened was I started asking around a lot of people in the field. I saw you had Paula Kluth on one of your shows. She's a friend and an advisor and does bits on it at Syracuse and lots of people. And I said, what is it, what kind of model should I be showing just to demonstrate what it takes to support and include these kids successfully? You have these disabilities. And certain words just kept coming up again and again, positive behavioral support. Universal design for learning, differentiated instruction. We could talk more about these if you want during the podcast, but there are certain educational practices that are so widely respected and as evidence-based practices that help all kids learn, but unfortunately they're not being implemented in that many schools.
Right,
and
exactly.
What I found was that, luckily in my own state, some of my colleagues at the Institute on Disability at UNH, where I'm a filmmaker, had been doing work in this high school, and it's a pretty low-income community. They don't have a lot of resources, but they are committed to finding a way to get every kid to graduate. And they had one of the highest dropout rates in the state. And then they said, really they brought in positive behavioral supports, or PBIS, positive behavioral interventions and supports, also called, as a dropout prevention mechanism. They had an expert in who said, if you do this and do it well, you will dramatically reduce your dropout rate. So that got everybody on board because they had a lot of pressure from the state to reduce the dropout rate. So they did that, and while at the same time they implemented a specific program or an approach called Renew, which is part of the film, which is a person-centered planning approach for kids who are at great risk of dropping out. So it's a way for kids who the insurmountable odds to graduating to find a way to build a team around them, advisors and supporters, and to break down those paths that seem so huge into more manageable, attainable steps towards graduation. So over 4 years, they reduced their dropout rate by 75%, and they reduced their disciplinary problems by 55%. And Kelsey, turns out, was in the middle of that transformation.
I'm hearing a lot of different kind of buzzwords for those who are very familiar with inclusion. I'm hearing positive behavior intervention and supports. I'm hearing universal design for learning. I'm hearing person-centered planning. Those are all things that that as a believer in inclusion, for all kids, are really, really important. How did this particular high school get all of that support all at once? Like you said, Kelsey was a lucky recipient of being that an environment, and then also you being involved with this film, highlighting the changes, that affected her and the school. And how does that happen exactly?
Sure. Well, it can happen in a lot of different ways depending on the school. One thing I will say is, as I've talked to a lot of people around the country, money is not the biggest factor here in any school's transformation and inclusion. Yes, education needs money. There's no doubt about it.
Right.
You want to be able to have a good staffing ratio. You want to have properly trained staff. You want to have good technology, of course. And that's just about good education. What I think I found makes the biggest difference is great leadership. And Somersworth has that, and a great principal, Sharon Lamprey. I think it's very difficult to have this type of positive transformation and progress without strong leaders. And you also need an attitude within a school that we're about supporting every kid and not giving up on any kid. And we are going to presume that every kid is competent. We're going to make sure everyone in the building knows that every kid can be successful. And all of us understand that, listen, a lot of us struggled when we were younger, whether we have a disability or not. There were periods in our life where we struggled. And, you got to get kids through those bumps. So specifically in Somersworth, there was a New Hampshire Department of Education grant that incentivized positive behavioral supports, because that's an approach that is seen as a practice that's effective across the country. And maybe we can talk just about what it is very briefly in a minute. But once that was incentivized, they were able to get some training for their staff, and that was certainly helpful. The fact that there was somebody to help facilitate the process from UNH and the Institute on Disability was extremely helpful. But I'd say really the capacity has to be built internally. And ultimately that's what happened at Somersworth. They weren't relying on outside consultants for years. They took this on themselves, and they learned that really what it's about when you look at positive behavioral supports or PBIS is looking at the school and saying, listen, 80% of the students here are going to be successful if we have a really positive, healthy school climate and culture and good instruction, right? About 80% are going to be successful. Now, that's easier said than done. So a lot of the focus of their implementation of PBIS was about working on that school culture and making it a place that kids felt safe, the staff felt safe, they felt like a strong sense of community, there was a feeling of respect, there was consistency around discipline and language around discipline, you know, all those important things.
Mm-hmm.
Then there are maybe 10 or 15% of kids who need something more. You know, they need extra instructional support. So they might need to check in with someone in the morning and check in with someone at the end of the day, you know, just check in, check out. That's what, you know, in PBIS language is called kind of that yellow tier of support, kids who might need something extra. And then there are the Kelseys of the world who have everything going against them, and they're going to need intensive support, or they will either drop out or school, in many cases, are going to farm them out to, you know, a quote-unquote special school for the behavior problems, which is often, you know, a sinkhole for these kids.
Yeah.
They're just around lots of kids with really challenging behavior, and that's just not a really good roadmap. So, you know, Kelsey was a kid that has severe ADHD. She also deals with depression and anxiety. She is very public about the fact in the film that she was sexually abused as a kid. She was self-mutilating, you know, for 8th grade, 9th grade. Her mother was very heavy into drugs. Her dad's kind of emotionally disconnected. All of her siblings pretty much, you know, many of them had teen pregnancies or it didn't make it through school. So she had, there was a lot going on in her life that was putting her on a direction towards dropping out, probably incarceration, probably drug abuse and pregnancy. And the film is really about how the school worked with her to change her trajectory to the point now where she's taking college classes, trained to be a firefighter and traveling around the country with me on this film tour, you know, hopefully holding people's minds up.
Yeah, it's great to see the transformation that Kelsey goes through, mm-hmm. you know, at the end of the film. You know,
yeah.
I don't want to give away too much, you know, but, you know.
It's okay. Now, people hopefully catch it on public television. They can see it there.
That's right. And, well, since you brought that up, September 28th, it's going to be on public television, but not everywhere. It's only going to be at certain cities. Is that correct?
Yeah. The best way to know it's going to be in your listeners' area to go to our website, whocaresaboutkelsey.com. There's a big red public broadcast label right on the front, and just click on that, and it lists where all the broadcasts are happening and when all around the country on public television. And then Kelsey and I are also doing a lot of screening events this year, so we have a whole upcoming screening pad as well. So we're traveling, and it's also going to be on public television this fall.
Excellent. Are you, since I'm based here in Georgia, I didn't see any Georgia dates. Have you been to Georgia? Are you planning on coming to Georgia at all?
You know, I was in Georgia for the Positive Behavioral Supports Conference about a year ago.
Uh-huh.
So the next time I'd be there, I might be there. My son Samuel wants to go see the NASCAR race in Talladega, so we may just be going on a pleasure trip staying in Atlanta. But so what happens is we tend to get invitations from all around the country, and then
uh-huh.
when we get those, we try and go to those places. But, so unfortunately, I won't be able to in your backyard anytime real soon, as far as I know about.
Well, that, no pressure or anything.
Yeah, I would too. I'd like to. I'd like to see you in person.
Let's talk about this idea of good kids and bad kids,
mm-hmm.
because I think that that's what many students who are in the same situation as Kelsey kind of get labeled as. You know, well,
right.
they're just a bad kid.
Right.
And unfortunately, it's something I've heard before. It's something other educators and other parents have heard before, that these are just bad kids. And if I was, you know, if they were my kid, you know, mm-hmm. I would, you know, and give a list of reasons why they
sure.
wouldn't be acting that way. Is there such thing as a bad kid or a good kid? And do we ever sure. get into the situation of, well, you know, we just can't save everybody?
Sure. First of all, I almost named this film No Bad Kids. So that's meaning there are no bad kids. So
mm-hmm.
that kind of gives away my hand. I don't think there are bad kids. I mean, I think there are kids who have bad behavior, challenging behavior, problematic behavior, dangerous behavior even. But I think that behavior, it happens for a reason. And
mm-hmm.
I think behavior is often a form of communication.
Mm-hmm.
I think when kids are acting out or being, whether they're a year old or 2 years old or 18, there's a reason for that. So a lot of kids, let's say in middle school or high school, they may find that by acting out, they're getting something that they need. It might be attention because they're not getting enough attention either at school or at home. They might get tossed out of the classroom where they're not feeling successful because they're struggling in school, and so it's a lot better just to get tossed out of the classroom. They might, if they're lucky, maybe even get suspended. And then I've talked to kids. I did an interview as part of this project for some mini films that we can talk about that I did. I interviewed incarcerated youth, and they talk about how when they were teenagers, they loved getting suspended. They would be on their own. They'd hook up with some friends. They'd drink. They'd smoke. They'd have sex. You know, it was a great day. And it just shows you the failure of these punitive approaches, because what you find is that when you figure out what is at the root of the kid's behavior, you know, some kids really do need to be taught behavior, you know, and those are kids who are not necessarily, you know, sociopaths or anything, but I mean, kids who just, for whatever reason, they just don't necessarily know certain appropriate behavior. Behavior needs to be taught just like English and math and social studies.
The film, Who Cares About Kelsey, and then also the mini films, which are fabulous, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
They mostly talk about older kids. And I know that you have the one mini film about, I'm not going to say her name right. Is it Tasha? Tasha?
Yeah, that's great. Tasha.
Yes. Is a little autistic girl who mm-hmm. has the support that she has in her elementary school. Can you talk a little bit about what elementary and middle schools can do as in regards to PBIS and how to support, you know, kids that have some challenging behavior?
Yeah, of course. You know, actually, nationally, more elementary and middle schools practice positive behavioral supports, PBIS, than high school. So in the case of Kelsey and Summers with High, that's more the exception than the rule. Mm. And of course, even at the preschool level, more program, it's called program-wide positive behavioral supports. And there's a stat that is really stunning that is, if you can imagine, what do you think is the grade level at which more kids are expelled than any other level?
I wouldn't know.
Preschool.
Really?
Preschool. More kids are expelled in preschool than any other level in school, which is stunning.
That is
about.
Stunning. Mm-hmm.
But partly because, you know, they can, because most preschools are private, but partly because behavior is just so misunderstood at every age, and particularly at that age. So, you know, I think at the elementary and middle school level, many of the practices that I tried to show in the film and the mini film that you mentioned, which people, by the way, can watch on our website for free. If you go to our whocaresaboutkelsey.com, there's a whole multimedia section that you probably found that has all these films. The Kelsey story was dramatic, and it covered a lot of ground, but I wanted to cover even more ground. And I wanted to show things like a kid like Marcel. Hmm. Actually, Marcel is a film that's just on the education kit that we sell, but I'll just tell you briefly. That one looks largely at racial disparity in discipline. There's tremendous racial disparity as well. African-American boys are disciplined and punished at a much higher rate than white kids. So you see that in his story. You also see a kid who escalates very quickly and intensely to violence, and how the school handles that in a really amazing way by saying, you know, what is it the root of this behavior? And there's something called a functional behavioral assessment that's done, particularly when kids are younger, that you've done any time, where you have a kid with really challenging behavior, like a Marcel or a Taja, and you say, well, let's track when this behavior occurs. Let's really track it for a couple of weeks and do some research and say, let's look for everything that happens before the behavior occurs and really look and see, is there something that's triggering that challenging behavior, and is there a way to eliminate that trigger? For a kid like Taja, who's a girl with autism that you mentioned, where she goes to school that has positive behavioral supports, has incredible staff. They use augmented communication devices for kids like Taja. She has access to one. But basically, they found that one of her triggers was the word no, that they realized after tracking this for a while that every time someone said no, she would have a behavior. Now, you might say, well, you got to say no, right? But there are other ways to say no. I mean, there's ways to redirect a kid like Taja and say, Taja, this isn't the best time for that right now. How about we do this instead? Now, you didn't say no, and she actually responded very well to that. So the other thing that I tried to look at was, are there critical times in kids' lives where things go awry? And what I found in interviewing the 6 incarcerated youth that I made short films about is that often it was middle school. And often it was because they weren't necessarily the troublemakers, but they were kids like Tariq, who was coming to school drunk every day in seventh grade, and nobody noticed. So he'd be in the back of the room sleeping. He wasn't making trouble, but the only time he got in trouble was when he was drunk and he got caught by the cops. And then he'd get arrested. He got arrested 10 times in middle school. So here's a kid that obviously needed some help, obviously needed some more proactive intervention, and he wasn't getting it. All he was getting was punished. So to me, those were incredibly insightful, these interviews, and these were just incredibly powerful and eloquent people to talk about what happened in life. Another one is Nicole, who I interviewed, and when she was 14, she got involved in a very emotionally abusive relationship with a boy, and I won't kind of tell too much about the story. It's a very powerful story, and I'd like it to kind of unfold as people watch it, but she ended up doing something really, really horrible because this boy manipulated her. And then one more, I'll just mention the story on Axel. It was truly a story on a kid who was underestimated for many years, a kid with autism. And then when he went to this new school, coincidentally also in Summersworth, they worked so hard to give him the communication tools he needed. And for many kids who don't have good access to communication tools, like a device or some type of system, the only way they can show what they want is by acting out or yelling or having some behavior. You know, it's this desperate attempt to say, pay attention to me, I'm trying to tell you something. And my own son Sandal has a communication device. I'm a huge believer in working extremely hard to get kids access to that. I did a film on restraint and seclusion, which people can also watch on the site, that was funded through a grant from TASH. And the stories there are so painful because kids who didn't have active communication were really abused for years because, A, they couldn't express what they really needed or wanted, and, B, they couldn't really tell anybody that they were being, restrained and secluded and really abusive ways at school. So it's an awful story, but an important one, I think, to tell.
Yeah, I mean, everything that you're bringing up is so important, especially for educators to understand that there are so many things behind the way that a student behaves, and also something that we kind of assume when we talk about functional behavior assessments or, you know, analyzing behavior, is that behavior is this negative thing when it's really right. It's really not only negative or only positive. It's really a mixture of things, you know, and just like you or I and what we do and what we're motivated by, it's never all, you know, one positive good thing or not all one positive negative thing. Everything overlaps, you know, meanings overlap. So it's a much more complicated issue, and especially when you have students who are nonverbal, if you don't have if they don't have a functional communication system, then you're going to see a lot of things that are going to be interpreted as negative. And also, I'm not sure if this ever comes up in the film or any of the mini films, but health is also a huge reason for someone to, you know, quote unquote, act out. You know, if you have an ear infection, if you have, pain in your body, if you have headaches, if you don't have a functional communication system, all that stuff is going to affect how you behave. And then you get labeled as a bad kid. So
exactly. You know, you're really hitting some really important points. And it reminds me of two comments that I heard that really inspired me to do this project. One was, I was up in Buffalo showing, including San Diego, Buffalo, New York, and a mom was saying she had a child with some emotional behavioral disabilities. And that child, if he didn't have his shoes tied just a certain way in the morning, if he didn't have just the right pants on, just the right food, with just the right texture, and just the right order, you know, I mean, he would blow up. He would just have a real meltdown. And so she would work so hard every day to keep everything, you know, in order for him and meet his needs. And it would take so long, but she would get him out the door. And then some days he might still be out with her and have some challenging behavior. And she would get judged for being a bad mom. Mm-hmm. It's about the kids being judged, and it's also about the parents often being judged for their kids' behavior. And this mom was just crying and saying, they don't even know what I do just to get my kid out the door every day. And in a similar vein, I was speaking to a kid at a screening, and he was telling me that just to get through every day of school, people have no idea what it takes. You know, how much concentration, how much patience, how hard it is for him to do this, because just the stimulation of school and the things kids are saying, and you know, frankly, every time I go into my son's family's middle school, I'm just like, wow, this place is completely overwhelming. I don't know how they do it every day. I don't know how the teachers do it. I don't know how the kids do it. It's just so intense. And, you know, and yet we expect our kids to not have, you know, to not ever get grumpy or angry or impulsive or respond, where, you know, we as adults do that stuff all the time. And I think sometimes we give our kids less slack than we give ourselves or our partners, you know?
Yeah, yeah. A couple more things before we, you know, wrap up our conversation. The first thing is I'd like for you to talk about, you know, what positive behavior intervention supports really is, and you know, maybe give an example of what it's not. Because when I talk to people, you know, about applied behavior analysis, positive behavior support, they have a preconceived idea of what that is, and it's a very clinical. It's a very clinical idea. Subjecting our students as lab rats and being very, you know, poking and prodding, see what kind of behaviors come out and, you know, stuff like that. Can you kind of speak to that a little bit?
Sure, I'd be happy to. And let me just say first, I'm a filmmaker, so often I like to communicate through film. And so I'm going to just point you to one more mini film on our website called Education Revolution at Somerset High School. And that's a 13-minute film that shows how the school transformed through positive behavioral supports. And it really puts a picture on positive behavioral supports and what it looks like and feels like in a school. So in addition to what I'm about to tell you, I hope people can check that out on the website. But basically, first I'll start with what PBIS is not. And first of all, positive behavioral support is kind of the whole principle of this approach that we'll be talking about. Positive behavioral intervention and support is a kind of a very specific framework that is developed and over decades at federal level and is now supported by a National Technical Assistance Center, which is basically under the federal government, and people can look at it at PBIS.org. And I really recommend people go to that site. It's incredible. And all the gurus who've really been working on this for decades are part of that organization. But PBIS is not a packaged curriculum or something you download or buy or a specific intervention. It's really a framework, a decision-making framework that guides a school in selecting and integrating and implementing best practices. So when we talk about universal design for learning or differentiated instruction or augmented communication, all these things can fall under this PBIS umbrella, and it's a framework for organizing it. And I have actually gotten to know it in a couple different ways, because not only have I studied it through this film, I've actually been part of the middle school team where my son Daniel goes in implementing it the last 2 years at their school. So what I would say is important for people to know is that it's almost the polar opposite of the zero-tolerance, three-strikes-you-out policies that are very reactive to behavior, okay? So when you see challenging behavior, you react, you punish, you discipline, you put kids in detention, you throw them out of school. But unfortunately, those approaches have absolutely no evidence of working. They don't change behavior. They don't get at the source of behavior. They don't teach behavior. And they actually don't create safer schools. There's no evidence to suggest that. Whereas PBIS has a tremendous amount of literature behind it that suggests that when you basically think about positive approaches to dealing with behavior issues, so you incentivize good behavior as much as possible rather than just punishing bad behavior. It doesn't mean that you let kids off the hook. There's still consequences, but those consequences are consistently applied over the whole school. So it's positive, it's behavioral, so it understands that behavior is a form of communication. It's interventions, and interventions mean you're delivering interventions for kids for whatever they need. So for a typical kid, they might just need a good, strong, healthy school environment. That's the intervention, and good instruction. But for a kid like Kelsey, they need renewal. They need a person-centered planning or wraparound, a little more intensely. And then it's supports. So what does a kid like Kelsey need to be successful? What kind of supports does she need? And I tell you, I worry particularly around the Common Core, which I think is a really good idea. We need Common Core standards. I worry that we're raising the bar, which is good. You know, we're making sure that kids really develop these competencies. But I do worry that even more kids are going to fall through the cracks, like Kelsey. Because if you're not delivering the kind of support they need to learn the Common Core, where are they going to be at? You know, what's going to happen to them?
Yeah.
So you know, I've just seen PBIS work as an organizing framework at a school level. You have the kind of discussions you kind of have the strategy and strategic approaches you need in order to run a very complicated system, which is a school.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point about about the Common Core. And, you know, it's something that that a lot of educators are just having a hard time putting, you know, wrapping their mind around, you know, what exactly that is. I think what I'd like to know, I'd like to know what you think about how PBIS can be implemented, you know, nationwide, because there are, you know, you've talked about this before, not on this podcast, but in lots of other places, how inclusion, PBIS, really is only practiced in pockets around the country. So certain states will be doing well in a certain area, but really only certain counties in that state. And then other states will be doing something else a little bit different or better, you know. And then, so how do we get PBIS and universal design, you know, and differentiated instruction? How do we get those things, those major ideas, into more schools?
Right, that's a great question. Well, there's several thoughts that come to mind. One is that I think we need to educate our leaders at the state and federal level, and many at the federal level really already get this because I've had a chance to talk to a lot of them. But at the state level, you know, really demonstrate the evidence that these approaches improve student achievement, because I think that so much of this comes down to student achievement, and as it should. You know, you want kids to be successful, but you know, so I think on one hand, you want to make sure they know that this will actually help kids learn. It will improve their academic achievement. It'll improve their chances of graduating from school and going to college. And there's evidence to suggest that. It also tends to address a lot of disparities, whether it's economics or racial disparities, in terms of which kids are being served well and which kids are not being served well. I think that's important for them to know as well. But I also think that there is this, you know, I ask the question a lot when I go to public speaking, which I do a lot in around the country, and I ask the audience, when you think of who you are today as a person, and I don't mean like your job necessarily, although that's a piece of it, but you know, your relationships, your hobbies, your passions, everything, the whole picture. And then you look back to your education, especially K-12, what had a bigger influence on forming who you are today? Was it the academic experience at school, or was it the social and emotional experience at school? And do you want to guess what the ratio typically is?
I'm sure it's more social emotional.
It's like 98% social. And what's interesting about that is if you ask the same question, say, well, how much of our time do we spend in schools focused on academics versus social and emotional? It's going to probably be 98% academic. So I think part of this is also looking more holistically at our kids and who we want them to become as adults, and realizing that focusing on behavior is a really good and productive thing. It's a very healthy way to spend time, you know, supporting our kids and helping them be successful. And they need to learn social and emotional skills in order to navigate a lot of challenges in life, academic and otherwise. So that's one thing. I think, you know, that's just general awareness. There are some really exciting efforts to scale up some of these practices happening right now, and I'm actually fortunate to be involved in one of them. There was a major grant awarded called SWIFT. I don't know if you're familiar with this at all.
Yes.
But so there was a request for a proposal from the federal government, like a $25 million grant, to create a national technical assistance center basically for inclusive education. But it's even bigger than that. I mean, it's really about all these things we're talking about. How do we scale that up nationally? So University of Kansas got the grant, but the Institute on Disability at UNH, where I work, is one of the kind of subcontractors. And I'm part of a 5-year grant to do films around the country at 6 knowledge development sites, they're calling them. And they're really schools that have shown they're among the most amazing inclusive public schools in the country. So by studying them, by showing them on film, by educating them, then by having these states that are called implementation states, they're trying to basically scale up these practices to a statewide level. And it's very, very exciting. And I think people are extremely jazzed about it, and they see it as the best hope we have right now to show that these approaches that we've been talking about for the last 45 minutes or so can be scaled up to a state and national level. So I have huge hope for it.
Yeah, I'm very hopeful too. I'm hoping that at the end of, you know, I'm not sure, is it a 3 or 5 year grant?
I believe it's a 5-year grant.
Okay, so at the end of that 5 years, we'll have some really concrete data, not only data, but also, you know, examples, like with what you're doing with the filming,
Yeah,
that we
and
can
implementation too. I mean, there
exactly.
should be states that have really already had a lot of implementation as well.
Yeah, so we can use that as a really a catalyst to change, the what, what kids need and how all learners can benefit from that.
Right, exactly. I mean, listen, this is a democracy, and we can't tell everybody, and we shouldn't tell everybody what to do in every single community. We not a dictatorship. What we have to do is show what the research and the evidence says is working, and really
Right.
educate people and give. And I also do think that there's a power in film. And show, some people are completely convinced by the data, but I think most people want to see it too. They want to see what it looks like. And that's why I feel so fortunate to do the work I do through film. And I wanted to mention one other thing that we're doing right now, which is related to this, is I think that, we named the film Who Cares About Kelsey? Because on one hand, you could say, well, who the hell cares about Kelsey? She comes from a rough family. She's probably going to drop out. She's not really worth the effort. But really, as you go through the film, you see just who cares about Kelsey. And you see her mentor, Kathy Francoeur. You see the principal. You see members of her family and their own complicated ways of caring about her. And then ultimately, she cares about herself. And that's what really makes the difference. But what we decided to do with this national launch is that we're also launching a campaign called I Care By Blank. What are you doing in your everyday life to show that you care about kids who are struggling? And we offer very simple suggestions for people to take on a daily basis, whether you're an educator, a family member, a youth, to make a difference in the lives of kids. And we're giving them very concrete steps they can take. So we're actually going to be launching that end of September. So I'm not sure when this will be on the air, but hope it'll be launched by the time this is broadcast at icareby.org. And again, it uses film as a way to teach some of these lessons.
Well, excellent, excellent. Thank you for the conversation, and I have one more quick question for you. It's
Sure.
very important. Are the Red Sox going to win the World Series?
I sure hope so. We just watched the game tonight, and they beat the Orioles. So again, depending on when this actually airs, we're hoping that your listeners will be watching them in the American League Championship Series, winning, and then going to World Series. We are big, big fans in this family, and I remember a few years ago when they played the Yankees and they came back from 3 games down. I just lost so much sleep that week, and I was so tired, but I loved every minute of it. How about you? Are you rooting for them?
Well, no, I'm a Los Angeles Dodger fan, so
Oh, well, we might be seeing you in the World Series.
exactly, yeah. I still have the 1998 World Series Kirk Gibson home run ingrained in my
Nice.
brain. So
Nice. Nice. That was very memorable. Well, we're going to be rooting for, right now we're looking for a Pirates Red Sox World Series. No offense, but we just think that family, I think that would be fun.
Well, that would be pretty interesting. Yeah, I definitely have my bias, and since I am in the Atlanta area, I do have a special place in my heart for the Braves. But
Yes, they're good too.
I grew up in Los Angeles, so that's my team.
All right, well, we might see one of your teams against the Red Sox, but the Red
Okay.
Sox will certainly be there. Well, it
Okay.
was really good to talk with you. Thanks so much for having me on.
Absolutely. Thank you for your time.
Sure.
That concludes this edition of the Think Inclusive podcast. For more information about Dan Habib and the film Who Cares About Kelsey, make sure to visit the website whocaresaboutkelsey.com. You can watch the mini films, find statistics and articles about the issues brought up in the film, find out when the film will be broadcast in your area, links to purchase the film, or even win your very own screening of the film. You can also follow on Twitter at WCA Kelsey. Remember, you can always find us on Twitter at think_inclusive or on the web at thinkinclusive.us. Today's show was produced by myself, talking into USB headphones, using a newly refurbished MacBook Pro, GarageBand, and a Skype account. Bumper music by Jose Galvez with the song Press. You can find it on iTunes. You can also subscribe to the Think Inclusive podcast via the iTunes Music Store or Podomatic, the largest community of independent podcasters on the planet. From Marietta, Georgia, please join us again on the Think Inclusive podcast. Thanks for your time and attention.